So I actually was going to call this talk Santa's Grotto, but I chickened out, basically. And the reason I was going to call it Santa's Grotto was I was speaking to a friend of mine before I came on the retreat, and he'd been at his daughter's school all day, and he'd been building a Santa's Grotto for their primary children. So he'd made it out of various things that were lying around in the school hall, boxes and bits and bobs, and he put a nice little plywood door on it saying knock before you enter. Santa went in and the children came along, and he just sat back and he really enjoyed it because some of the children were absolutely terrified. They just a lot of them couldn't even knock on the door. You know how it is with children 6 years old. So basically he was very pleased, and he said to me, it's a bit like a shrine, really. I feel like I've made a shrine to Santa. And of course, no, we're not like that anymore. We're not scared of, you know, Santa anymore. So obviously we changed a bit as children. So from when we were children. So I mean, if I said that Santa Claus was behind that curtain, for example, you know, he's wearing his big boots behind there now. There's in his chair. That wouldn't be at all. If I said, would you like to go and have a look? Just peek behind the curtain. I mean, I think we can still be frightened by Santa Claus, basically. And, you know, if just the suggestion that Santa Claus is behind that, I find a little bit frightening. But he's not there. He's not there. Okay. So, but the point I want to make is that we can and we do respond in a very simple way to shrines and images, even though we're quite sophisticated sort of, and we're quite rational, and we think of ourselves in... I talk for myself personally, right? I kind of tend to over-identify with being rational and being reasonable. And I always have done, and with shrines and images and things, I've tended over, you know, the time when I've been a Buddhist to ignore them. Not quite ignore them, to look at them out the corner of my eye and sort of tolerate them. Other people would make them and enjoy them, and I would just sort of... I sort of go along with it in a way, but... you know, as time has gone by, I've noticed that, and it's a sort of health warning, really, that shrines and images, I mean, along with all the other things that you get in Buddhism, you know, books and talks and meditation experience and all the other things, add up to quite a package of quite a powerful thing. So this is just made out of old bits and bobs we found lying around here. This is school material, and you know, it's not Santa's Grotto, but there, and you might find it doesn't have a really strong effect, not like if it was Santa, but over the time I've come to appreciate that that I have let some of these images speak to me. Yeah, I thought I just wanted to say that there's sort of a health warning, really, that, you know, it's just that we do over... I mean, I do over-identify with being a rational person, but so much of me... I mean, I only have to go to the theatre or watch a film and read a poem, and I'm not a rational person, but I... there's a deeper thing, and also in these images, in that they carry something that's quite powerful. And somebody said it before about if you make a little movement towards these, you have to be a little bit open to them, but it's as if there's something pressing through these things from the other side. And it may not be that, you know, it takes a while for that connection to become clear. But for me, we do need some way of reaching beyond ourselves. And if these things, if these archetypal enlightened figures can help us imagine something that's beyond ourselves or our current way, and then I say all the better to consider them. And I certainly have gained a lot out of considering Ratnasambhava. And... he's been very fruitful. He's a very easy figure to relate to. He is associated with the human realm, and he points to qualities that are really useful for living a better life. So, that's a sort of preamble. The Buddha, he often used to meet, the kings in the Buddha's time. So there was a lot of kingdoms, small kingdoms. They often used to meet holy men. They often used to invite them to come and have a meal. and they would want to hear what the holy man had to say for various reasons. I mean, it could have been advising them about warfare or all sorts of things, I guess. But a lot of them also had quite a strong response to the spiritual life at that time. And one king in it, and I haven't got the reference for this because the Pali Canon is absolutely huge and I couldn't find it, but he invited the Buddha to come and have a meal. And after the meal, he had a question for the Buddha. And the question was something like this. It was something like, how come you claim to be happy? I mean, I've got all these things. I've got all these palaces, these pleasure gardens, these concubines. I've got everything that I need. And how come you... And the Buddha was just a sort of scruffy mendicant. I mean, he'd just been scraggy, probably, unshaven, unkempt, wearing rags that were made up of old rags stitched together. It didn't have... I was going to use a rude analogy there, sorry, can't do that. A pot to in. But basically, so that was his question. That was the king. But I always see this like there's people in our society now who would have exactly the same question, and we ourselves would have exactly the same question as the king had. If you imagine someone like Alan Sugar, for example, if you're willing to, he's a man who has in his life been able to have everything. I don't need to really elaborate on what he could buy and what he could have or he could probably afford to pay Nigella Lawson to come around and cook him Christmas dinner. You know, he could get anything that he wanted, basically. And it would be a matter of some annoyance or impertinence, possibly, that somebody could just be living a life where it was so simple. And what they said, well, I don't need all those things, you know, you've got... And it's almost an affront. That's how I imagine this encounter. It might not have been like that, but... Hey. The Buddha sort of responded to this by saying, well, yeah, I think, okay, so you've got all these things and you're happy, but so you must be able to sit for a minute happy. Just sit for a minute content and happy. And the king said, yeah, well, I can do that. That's not a problem. I can do that. And the Buddha said, well, what about an hour? Could you sit for an hour quite happily? And the king thought about it and said, yeah, I could sit for an hour quite happily. And then the Buddha said, well, what about a day? Could you sit for a day, quite happy, quite contented? And the king had to admit that he couldn't do that. I mean, he couldn't sit there for a day. He would get restless, and he'd be off hunting, going to the harem or whatever. He'd just get bored, you know. He wouldn't be able to do that for a day. So the Buddha said, without pride, that he could sit for a long time perfectly content. In fact, radiantly content, and joyful and unperturbed. So the Buddha, who'd given up every sign of worldly life, all his possessions except for rags and a begging bowl, and this can look like a pretty miserable existence from our perspective, maybe, certainly from the king's perspective, is so rich in this in inequalities that this lack of these outward these goods is not a big deal. And to an extent, we here on this retreat have followed the Buddha's example by putting down some of our worldly concerns for some time in order to develop that inner wealth. So Ratnasambhava is, of all the Buddha figures, embodies inner wealth and riches. He expresses that state of the enlightened mind which appears in the world as expansiveness and abundance and creativity. And it stands against all those states where we feel contracted or defensive, self-protecting, mean-spirited, or just plain stuck. And Ratnasambhava invites everything into his domain, so it with a big yes. And from the perspective of this figure here, from his perspective, everything's ripe, as you can see. Everything's abundant, flowers, everything is overflowing, you know, just completely abundant. And there's nothing to be strived after. At least, you know, this image gives us an idea of the inner state that's being talked about here. And the colour yellow, or gold, is the colour of ripeness and riches. So we'll find out later. I'll say a bit more about what kind of possible wisdom could bring about such a state of mind. And I want to look at this in three ways. So there's many ways you can talk about Ratnasambhava, but I'll just stick to three. Okay, and the first is to do with abundance of energy. The second is to do with an expansiveness of self as an image for spiritual life. Spiritual life, yeah. And the third is the practice of giving. And these relate to that by... Actually, in the traditional image, the Ratnasambhava is sitting on four horses. He's not there for some reason, but he does sit on four horses. And those horses are connected with energy. And the lotus is a symbol of transformation. And I'm calling that the expansive self. And this jewel here is called the wish-fulfilling jewel. And Ratnasambhava's supreme sort of appearance is through just giving, giving in without any limit. So those are the three things I'll be talking about. So the first thing is horses, okay? It's horses again. I'm sorry, you must think we're a bit mad about horses. Horses have never come up in a retreat I've been on before, so... horses obviously symbolise wealth. So if you've got horses, you're rich, okay? Even in today's society, you're well off. In the past, you had hundreds of them and you were the king. Horses symbolise the horsepower of the mind, if you like. They are the gathered energies of the mind in this image. So I'm going to read a poem. We like poems, don't we, as well as horses. This is another horse poem. Because I think it's a nice poem. Make me feel settled. Okay. It's by Pablo Neruda, and it's called Horses. I saw horses from the window. I was in Berlin in winter. The light was without light. The sky without sky. The air white like soaked bread. And from my window I saw a desolate arena bitten by the teeth of winter. Suddenly, conducted by one man, 10 horses stepped out of the fog. Gently wavering, they emerged like flames. Yet for my eyes, they filled the whole world, empty until this hour. Perfect, burning, they were like 10 gods, on large, chaste hooves, with manes like the dream of salt. Their rumps were worlds and oranges. Their colour was honey, amber, blazing. Their necks were towers cut from the stone of pride. And energy, like a prisoner, rose up in their furious eyes. And there in silence, in the middle of the day, in a dirty and dishevelled winter, the intense horses were the blood, the rhythm, the inciting treasure of life. I looked and looked and so returned to life. There unknowing was the fountain, the dance of gold, the sky, the fire that lives in beauty. I shall not forget the winter of that dark Berlin. I shall not forget the light of those horses. So horses are a pretty sort of powerful image, and I mean, I really like the energy like a prisoner rose up in their furious eyes. I mean, they are very wild, aren't they? They're very strong, they're very focused. And on this retreat, just to continue this horse thing, I'm sorry, we could say we're gathering our horses. Sometimes when we sit down to meditate, we might have no energy and we feel a bit like a little Dartmoor pony or something. And then other times we might feel we're just full of wild energies and we sort, you know, they're just running around and we're just trying to sort of lasso them, but it just, there's too much going on. And there's energy that we're gathering on this retreat, okay? And the metaphor of these horses is that if we're going to live any kind of creative life, We need to gather our energies to support that. Meditation and the spiritual life in general requires us to cultivate, channel and broaden, enliven our energy, making it at the same time more human, more flexible and more warm, more loving. So yeah, a weak and dissipated mind is, or a negative, inhumane mind is not the basis for a creative life, in however way we think about that. And it's certainly not the basis for moving towards the far horizon of creativity, which could be said to could be the sense of Buddhahood itself. Constant creativity. So, awareness is the key. We've heard a lot about this sort of thing already, so this is going to be familiar now. But it's like meditation and mindfulness in our day is a bit like horse training. You cannot hold the leash too tight or crack the whip too often, or the horse will get you back. You have to let the mind stay free and give whatever energy or mood you have your conscious attention. And by doing that, the mind will naturally start to cooperate more with your effort. So energy is transformed through awareness. Cruder energy becomes more refined and more playful and more just naturally enjoyable. Slothful energy is made brighter. So by focusing on the breath, for example, you just keep the wanderings of the mind within a kind and a spacious awareness and encourage the qualities of intention, attention and metta. And eventually the horses, the mind, will start to cooperate, and then you can really take off. You know, but it is important to say this is not the conventional ideal of energy I'm talking about, because we all want more energy. You know, I used to work in the city of London in a law firm. And the conventional ideal of energy was the Wellman vitamin range on the tube that was advertised to me, you know, where I've got to look great, I've got to work hard, play hard, and, you know, be great when I go home, good man about, and then go out and have fun. And, you know, and I just need to take these minerals. And, you know, this kind of caffeinated energy, which allows lawyers, among other people, to sort of do deals and stay up all night, and it keeps our consumer... our consumer activity going along, it's not really fit for the purpose of awakening. So the energy of enlightenment has opened up all the energies of the body, the heart and the mind, and it hasn't cut off or rejected any of them. It's a much more subtle idea of energy. We can't always be a gushing stream of energy. It's like, you know, the Chinese think about it in a much more subtle way. They talk about qi. They talk about yin and yang, which is yang being a more bright, spring-like, get-up-and-go type of energy, yin being a darker, more soulful, restorative kind of energy. And energy changes according to the season or according to the time of day. It's a much more variegated palette of responses to energy, and all those energies are appropriate at their own time. I mean, energy we think of is pretty much in a crude way sometimes, a bit like oil or something. So the kind of energy that we're talking about is not that conventional ideal of energy. I ask myself, have I got more energy? I'm talking about having energy. Have I got more energy since I've been doing this meditation and coming here and studying Buddhism and things like that? The answer is probably not. But the crucial thing about energy is that it's... because when I was 20, I had a lot of energy, and I've still got a reasonable amount of energy. I've never had a problem with energy. But this is to do with energy that is available to do what you hold more valuable. Okay, it's energy in this sense, it's energy to follow the Buddhist path. But more, what that really means is energy to do the things that you value doing, that you really value doing. Okay, and that's maybe not so easy. But I would say that in my experience, I definitely have been able to... just have more of myself available. Okay, so there's another thing about energy, is that we're all conflicted. I mean, we're naturally conflicted. And part of the path for me has been not exactly resolving, but becoming more aware of the conflicts in energy, parts of me that just want to do different things in life, you know. I had an image on a retreat that I was on a couple of years ago, and it was... of being at the top of a kind of hill and looking down a large valley, And I just saw all these rivulets and rivers and paths going down into the valley and way across the plain. And it was more like a plain than a valley. And I just saw that. Suddenly I saw, it's okay. There's many parts of me and they're all flowing along and they're different, they cross over, there's problems and conflicts. But I'm kind of aware that this is me, okay? There's things I can't resolve. I just have to start walking now across the plain. And it was this image that I'd seen that. But it was before, I definitely felt overwhelmed by these conflicts and not able to hold them in my awareness, really. And then that being conflicted often results in doubt and indecision about what you're doing with your life, or kind of, it can result in worse things, of course, if you're... energies are wildly conflicted, it can cause all kinds of mayhem in your life. But for me it was more like just doubt and not having been able to see a whole of myself. So, you know, so often it's just energy here is about the quality of energy that we bring, how we direct it and how we become aware of the conflicts in our lives and how we skillfully just point ourselves more and more to what we value, whatever that is. And, you know, that is an art. So that's energy. I do want to say one more thing. In some cultures, old age is the sweetest and most enjoyable time of life, and that's certainly not in our culture. But, you know, the stormy passage of being young and being middle-aged has sort of died down a bit. And more of a pure sort of enjoyment of life can come through. And although there are things about old age which are never going to be much fun, Sangharakshita, who's the founder of the Tree Ratna community, he said he's enjoying his life more in his 80s than he's ever done. And I find people who stay alive to their energies later in life and who are able to adapt their energies and somehow let go of an old image of what their energies were and stay on the creative current of their energy is very, very inspiring. I mean, I'm a big fan of Bob Dylan, and I think he gets better with age. You might not agree with that. But I'll talk to you later if you don't agree with that. So this topic of energy as horses leads on to the topic of expanding your sense of self. So expanding and transforming energy looked at from another point of view is expanding yourself. Okay, so I think this is a very helpful way of conceiving the spiritual life and finding those inner riches. So I'm going to explore what that means. If you think of the inner life, the path of the inner life in narrow terms, in terms of self-denial or giving up things or even worse, getting rid of things like the ego or stopping desires, the spiritual life for me is very unattractive after a while, and it's not even really possible. There's just no incentive to do it. It's just grim. And it's too easy to interpret Buddhism as in that way, if you were to think of it in that way, as a kind of a rather bleak encounter with nothing, really. And you'll probably bring to Buddhism some of your preset ideas about life and death. And I mean, I know I've always come from a place where I feel quite nihilistic, basically. That's my sort of baseline, nihilism. The other thing is that if you think of it that way, you're going to get more and more cut off from the kinds of bits of yourself. If you think about it narrowing down, you'll just cut off bits of yourself, and those are the things you should be really getting to know. So a much better image of the path is the path of towards this inner wealth of Ratnasambhava is transformation. And this is a lotus. I mean, the lotus is a symbol of transforming. It comes from the earth, the mud, and just blooms, you know, in the way flowers do. And so this is going to mean we're going to have to expand our conception of ourselves so that we can do this. And that means embracing life's difficulties and life's conflicts, even when they get very difficult and very conflicted. As well as embracing life's joys and mysteries. It means embracing our ordinary humanness, finding a way through the painful muddle that we call the world, and embracing an openness to things that we don't yet understand. hopefully we can get a taste of this on this retreat. And you have had and are having a space to experience yourself in a new way. But what does it actually mean to expand yourself? So a lot of this comes down to views and habits and ingrained ways of being. Now, through applying awareness day by day and year by year, we can get to know these sticking points in ourselves, these attitudes or these emotional positions that we take up. And they may have been going on for a very long time, and they probably often seem to stem from stances we took up as children in response to things outside our control. So awareness and metta, as I think Jnanavacharya said, starts to erode these attitudes. So in my own case, I'm trying to think of a long-term emotional habit that I have to share with you. Gosh. So I was born with a disability. And in my early years, they seemed to have contained a fair dollop of parental anxiety about whether I would fit in and whether I would be normal. As I grew up, I went through some bullying, and I adopted this position quite strongly that I needed to fit in. And my strategy for doing this was ordinary enough. I thought I'd try to be successful. I did. I was successful. I won't regale you with all my successes. Unless you'd like me to, right? So from a pretty early age, my disability was hardly ever mentioned again in my family, really. I was fitting in okay. However, there was an underlying cost to this success. And that I was having to blank out those bits of me which didn't fit with that successful image that I wanted to present both to myself, so I felt secure, and to my parents. I mean, this is a fairly recognisable scenario in one way or another, being successful and wanting to fit in. It's not unusual. But in my case, it led to a kind of over-defendedness. And you know, if something about me was criticised or... I don't like being criticised still, but you know, if something about me was criticised at work or anywhere else, really, it would seem to relate back somehow unconsciously to this sense that there was something wrong with me, and there was a danger that it was being pointed out or revealed. Somehow that I didn't really make that connection back to this early years, but I think it was there. And it would trigger very painful feelings. Nobody likes feedback. Negative feedback. But it just triggered very painful feelings. And so then I'd feel defensive. And if you're defensive, other people really experience that as an attack. So it's just a bit limiting for personal relationships, and it's limiting for yourself. So by seeing that dynamic and over quite a long period of time, I think I'm letting that go a little bit. I hope I am. You know, that's what I aim to do. Pema Chodron always talks about the big one. She's a Buddhist teacher. She talks about the big one. There's always a big one in your life. There's always a place you do not want to go. And you may be dimly aware of it, or pretty aware of it, or not aware of it. But it's really going into that big one that really unlocks a lot of energy. So, you know, that's an emotional position I built up for myself. It's easy, so people sort of blame their parents, and I never blame my parents. My parents were fantastic. I'm saying this, hello Mum, if you ever listen to this talk online. At some point you do have to say, well, I adopted that position. It may have been a reasonable response at the time, but I have now adopted that position, and I'm carrying on doing it. You might have long-term resentments. You know, you feel you've not got what you wanted from life, or you're owed something. And you can really take those and run with them, and you can take them to your grave. Now there are other things that people think that they lack this, or things never go right for them, or other people are incompetent, and it's always left to me to do things, or basically variations of I'm better or worse than other people in some way. But it comes down, views and opinions and habits come down to much more day-to-day levels than that as well. So it might have had a great day on this retreat yesterday. I did. No, that was the day before. I had a lousy day yesterday. Not lousy. I didn't feel so good. But, you know, so we just, next day we feel miserable and moody and we don't want people to please stay away. Well, we felt clear yesterday, but today it's a lot of doubt and confusion has set in. So then we might sit down to meditate, we might come here and we sit down and the first thought we have, people are really weird on this retreat. And when you think that, they seem to be really weird, in fact. It's a sort of, it's odd, you know, what we're doing. And then you think maybe the retreat's gone wrong, or maybe I knew this would happen to me. And you just get into a whole mix of emotions and thoughts that are stirred up one after the other. I think this has been explained very well already by Anuvacha. And you end up feeling a bit isolated through these thoughts. So you think, you feel a bit cut off from people. Then you feel unexpectedly hungry. But it's not lunchtime. The ginger biscuit won't do it. You know, the village shop's closed, so you think, well, I'll go and loiter by the tea area in the vague hope someone's going to rescue me from this state of mind. And, you know, the day goes on like that. But it's the shift to awareness that is the revolutionary bit. That's what Sangharakshita says, awareness is revolutionary. So instead of wishing you were in yesterday's mood and trying to push out a mood which doesn't fit with what you think you want to be happening or you think should be happening, you just welcome in what's happening and you trust that. So the self expands by allowing in the present and not stewing up some concocted inner narrative about, you know, which sort of builds on itself and, contains factual biases and all that. So on this retreat we're exploring all that. So I think expanding the self is a great metaphor. Let's go on, just going to have a drink. It's hardly coming out. That's not quite right, is it, on this bottle? Anyway, yeah, it's a great metaphor for the spiritual life. So the expansion of the capacity of our hearts for the joys and sorrows of life will be a gift for ourselves and for other people, definitely for other people. I always find stories of people who've forgiven the unforgivable, overcome hardship or transform difficulty in some way, very inspiring. So life can flow through us and we're not so quick to judge it as good or bad or impose our views, opinions or speculations. This is a difficult thing to do. I'm not just saying this glibly. It's not easy to allow to have our experience. It's all very well if we're having a nice time, but it is a hard thing to do. But the abundance of Ratnasambhava is such that he's expanded beyond the point where he is exclusively identified with himself as a wholly separate being to others. And the enlightenment experience, it breaches that dualism. So that gives you some idea of what a radical proposal this whole endeavour is. But hang on, I hear you say, doesn't Buddhism teach that there is no self? Okay. I don't hear you saying that now, but I'll assume that you are saying that. So it should be clear that what I don't mean is that we're upgrading our ego by expanding ourselves into a real luxury sort of ego. It isn't getting rid of the ego either. And there's a very big danger. I thought about trying to explain the doctrine of no self in Buddhism, but there's a huge danger. Because you say something about what the doctrine is, and then you have to qualify it to try to be understood, and then you have to qualify that qualification. And you start saying lots and lots of things, and even if there are some people by the end of it who think you still know what you're talking about, it's quite clear to yourself that you do not know what you're talking about, basically. But I am a sucker for punishment, so I thought I might have a go as well. I mean, in simple terms, if you think of a tree, you know, and it is an acorn, then it's a sapling, then it's 10 foot tall, then it's 50 foot, 100 foot tall, and then it's a log on the floor, okay, and we say it's a tree. So the Buddha was just pointing out that all there is change. There's birth and death, there's growth and decay. If we have to use words, those are good words to use, birth and death, growth and decay, or change. So at no point is there an unchanging tree that is separate from the attributes of the thing in front of us that we experience at that moment. There's no, it's a, yeah, treeing would be a more accurate way of putting it than a tree. But from a conventional point of view, there is a tree. I'll meet you by the oak tree. Yeah, it's a perfectly valid thing to say. Of course, we understand this. Okay. So from a philosophical point of view, about a tree, there's one thing. But then when it comes to ourselves, it's quite another. We live in a world where it's perfectly okay to identify ourselves as I. You know, this is just what we do. This is our realm. You know, of operating. We couldn't really function without identifying ourselves in the world. And yet, the analogy with the tree is still there, of course, there. But Buddhism isn't saying that we don't exist, which is a relief. But then some people say, well, we're a stream of data, or we're just sort of a bunch of conditions going on. Well, that doesn't seem to really characterize it either. Because, existence and non-existence are ultimately just concepts as well. And the Buddha wasn't making things easy for us. It's the middle way, and it's beyond concepts. And it's about experiencing more and more towards reality. So when the Buddha, he sat one evening, on a full moon evening, in front of 1,000 monks in a big assembly, and they were ready for him to give a teaching, and there was complete silence. The Buddha just held up a flower. And that was it. But he wasn't saying the flower exists. He wasn't saying the flower has no self. He wasn't saying the flower is the flower of no flower, or anything. This was the teaching. It was just holding up a flower. And apparently one monk understood. Okay. What? That's the origins of Zen Buddhism, apparently, because that's the transmission outside of words, outside of scriptures. There's no Buddhist Bible. There's no absolute way of saying things. There's no absolute way of communicating in a way that can't be misunderstood. So the Buddha held up a flower on this occasion. So if we let go of this, where am I now? The tendency that I was talking about to want things to be, want fixity in life. If we could open up to a fear of death a little bit, if we could find a way of coping with our deepest worries and insecurities, there might be a bit of light that comes in which says maybe my life is founded on a mistaken premise, that there is finally something real to defend. Something that is once and forever separate about me and special about me. And the Buddha saw this very deeply in his experience, and it wasn't a concept. And one of the main results of not believing in the final separateness of ourselves is a freedom from fear and a liberation of all the energies that are normally directed at the futile task of self-preservation. Because it's futile because the more and more you try to protect yourself, the more you implicitly believe in that self that you're trying to protect, and the more fearful you become. And the threats to the self posed by the outside world are vast, and they'll just increase in the proportion to the degree of your holding on and wanting to fix things. And the self, however much you puff it up, is not going to win, basically. It made me think of Colonel Gaddafi, the amount of fear that must be locked into a position like he was in his life. So what about the wisdom of Ratnasambhava? I better say a bit about that. Good. Ratnasambhava brings out the specific aspect of this wisdom that I've been talking about. He basically is saying that every living thing has the same spiritual potential. It's called the wisdom of sameness. The nature of all that lives is that it can transform towards awakening, and we're all equal and the same in that sense. And we have that because of the basic law of change. We can change for good or ill. So the creative life is using this fact of change, this open-endedness of experience, to reach more expansive states of mind. The uncreative life, and this, the reactive and creative are these terms that Sangharakshita coined to describe this spiritual movement from a reactive life. The reactive life is one where we're entrenching ourselves in learnt ways of being, not growing and not cooperating. And the far end of the uncreative life, or the reactive life, is more suffering and more of the same. Yeah. And the creative life is towards what we're going up to, the Buddha, really. And this is very useful in the Metta Bhavana, to reflect that all beings have the capacity to grow. Everybody can shed their skin, and everybody can increase in wisdom, compassion. You know, in a small way or a big way, we can all do that. You know, Ranasambhava, in a sense, heralds the good news that all beings can tread the path to awakening. So I want to say one more thing. We're going to move into this thing here, which is the wish-fulfilling jewel. And this is the practice of giving. But just to recap, so the symbolism of the horses shows us we need to co-opt our creative energies. If we're not in touch with them, then practices like meditation or yoga, which draw us away from things which dissipate us and wake up our bodies from sloth or unlock emotion that's been dammed up, we can do them. You know, once we have that energy, we need to channel it, and that's surely part of the art of living. I mean, you can be creative in any number of ways, through formal artistic things, through your work, through bringing up a family or living in some other way. And no one can tell anyone how to live a creative life, really. It's different for each person. We definitely don't want to dampen down our energies and be all nice and meek and, you know, and unenergized. But that is the creative sort of path with our energies. So the wisdom of Ratnasambhava, after he's followed the path, and that's the symbol of the lotus, the full flowering of all the dormant energies, urges us to reflect that all beings are in the same boat and deserving of the same kindness and empathy. So reflection, all these things are reflections, you know. So the wish-fulfilling jewel. Ratnasambhava means jewel-born or jewel-producing. This is, Ratna means jewel. Tree Ratna, three jewels, the Tree Ratna movement. This is like Aladdin's lamp, in a sense. It's a symbol of the ultimate gift, which is the awakened state, the ultimate gift, and it points at his character, which is once that's known, there's nothing to strive after. As it's Christmas, I'm going to quote a Christian mystic and a woman called Julian of Norwich, mysteriously enough, who lived in the 14th century. I really like thinking about the fact that there was a mystical tradition in England. And she said famously, you may have heard this, all shall be well, and all shall be well, and all manner of things shall be well. And that came to mind because I just thought, once the nectar of the awakened state is known, all is well. And the 1,000,000,000 things that make up the world are revealed as well also, even if they don't seem so from our perspective sometimes, all the time, actually, a lot of the time. So Ratnasambhava is giving in a way, by analogy here. Ratnasambhava is giving in the way we give to children. We don't expect anything back from children, and we don't expect them to reciprocate. We don't only give them Christmas present if they'd be... Actually, we do give them only Christmas if they're good to their little sister. Ratnasambhava wouldn't take that approach. So he gives freely, and it's inexhaustible. I was going to go on about Santa, but I'm not going to now. It's inexhaustible and bountiful, and these are aspects of reality, so you don't have to take these literally, but bountiful, inexhaustible giving. It's not really that Ratnasambhava is being generous. If someone gives a large donation to charity or comes around to babysit your children, they are being generous. And they might want you to do the same back. But you can make psychological observations about why people give things. And philanthropy is being discussed a lot at this time in the world. And it's probably best to just say, if you know, giving is a good thing. And if people give... it doesn't need to be the purest gift in the world, but giving is a good thing. But generosity in this sense is not the activity of Ratnasambhava exactly, because Ratnasambhava isn't engaged in an elevated form of philanthropy or social work. Right? His giving doesn't rest on the assumption of personhood and the transfer of ownership. in a sense, when we give, we are going beyond that idea of ownership. I mean, I don't really think when we give to our children, we think about it as transferring ownership. Or when I give to anyone, I don't always think of it in that way. So it's not cut and dry between my giving and Ratnasambhava's giving or whatever. But he's really gone beyond the sense of ownership. Okay. So this is probably the most important thing to do, is to take these Buddhist teachings into practical activity. And giving is an activity that's very fundamental in Buddhism. It's said that you can always give, whatever state you're in, wherever you find yourself in life, you can always give. And giving softens that division between me and you. You know, it somehow makes a connection between us. And I'm not going to produce a list of ways in which you can give, other than to point out you can give more than possessions. You can give time and energy. You can listen to people. You can share what you love, and you can encourage other people to give, you know, according to your, or other people, you can help them according to your own particular gift. That said, we shouldn't underestimate the just giving material things. And I am often very embarrassed by my tendency to hoard things. I mean, how many times have you done this? But I don't know, I do this quite a lot. I think, I'll give that to that person. On reflection, maybe I won't. You know, a little bit later, I might need that. And you lose that moment. You really do. You say, I really want to give that. And then next morning, maybe, you just think better of it. We shouldn't let ourselves off the hook just because we're below average wage or we're on the dole. Sangharakshita tells a story about visiting a high lama in Tibet. He used to live up in the mountains in Nepal. In India, northern India. There were a lot of Tibetans there at that time, and he met quite a lot of these guys. They were coming out of India. They were coming out of Tibet, let's get that clear. They were coming out of Tibet, and they were in this town that he was in. And he met this very high lama, who the Dalai Lama actually wanted to go and look after a big monastery. But the Lama just thought that he wasn't, for some reason he wanted to live a life of great poverty, and he just sat in a room, and his only possession was an upturned tin pot on which he balanced his book that he was studying. And Sangharakshita went to see him and got a teaching from him and had a communication with him. This is when he was learning about all these different types of Buddhism. And he presumably went away very glad. But this lama, he wanted to give Sangharakshita something. So he took off his beads, his mala, and he broke them. And he gave Sangharakshita a bead. And I mean, it's quite a thing to think about, really. I mean, we might look at a monk or somebody who's gone forth from possessions and think, well, I could maybe do that. It's actually really difficult to live with very little and live as a monk. And then to still want to give. Well, you'd have to still want to give if you were a monk. Otherwise, you would be really miserable. So it's probably common to think, what can I give? I have very little. I'm not rich. And I'll give when I win the lottery. I've had that embarrassing thought, you know. I do, I fantasize about it. I'll give him that. You know, I'll be majestic in my giving. Just wealth is thought of seen as something you externally possess. But the Ratnasambhava is reminding us that wealth is also a state of mind, and it's an inner feeling of abundance. It's very hard to hold on to that sense of inner wealth or inner abundance, because our society is so geared up to stimulating ephemeral desires for this and that. And it accords a low status or even a moral blame to people who don't have very much relative to other people. And it's clear that even a millionaire can feel quite poor because they have several million less than the next person along the road who can have a ski chalet and all that kind of stuff. And the poverty mentality can be in people who are very wealthy at every level of income. And they really feel that they might really feel that they don't have much. So let's not ourselves worry about poverty and wealth. We just begin by realizing that we can give, and we do give now. We can reflect that we do every day. Our actions affect other people, and that we probably give more than we realize. So we can celebrate that. In the highest sense, giving is giving. This is the highest sense of Ratnasambhava, I think. is giving of oneself. So Ratnasambhava urges us to become bigger, to increase in awareness and adopt an open-hearted attitude to the tapestry of life, without comparing and condemning. And along this path, we open up qualities that are uniquely us, that are waiting to be discovered. And that opening to the world is our communication with the world, and that is true giving, to be yourself, but not your small self, your unlimited, bigger, expanded self. So finally, I was on a 4-month retreat earlier this year, and among many things we did pujas and we performed ceremonies to evoke these figures. We viewed these figures imaginatively, of course, as embodiments of enlightened qualities, and we each held a different perspective, really, on whether they existed out there or they existed in here. And the most pleasing position for me, which I sort of finally got to, was, because I can be a bit sceptical, but the most pleasing position for me was to point out that in here and out there are not ultimate categories that we can locate in experience, really. And they are metaphors that relate to the outer and the inner world. You know, we use them as useful ways of talking, but they're not absolute metaphysical truths. So when we look at these figures, they invite their mind to grow. They're not an abstract system of symbols that can be rationally comprehended. And in making a connection with them, on whatever level, and whatever way, what we do, we're taking up a golden thread which leads back to qualities as yet dimly imagined. And at some point in the journey, we may realize that these qualities, which we imagined relating to a Buddha out there, are actually our own deepest nature. So the figure of Ratnasambhava is golden yellow, and he stands at the noonday zenith, shining equally and in fullness on all like the sun. And one more poem to finish. And this isn't about horses. This is called Solar. And it's by Philip Larkin. And it could have been written about Ratnasambhava. Suspended lion face, spilling at the centre of an unfurnished sky. How still you stand. And how unaided, single stalkless flower, you pour unrecompensed. The eye sees you simplified by distance into an origin. Your petaled head of flames continuously exploding. Heat is the echo of your gold. Coined there among lonely horizontals, you exist openly. Our needs hourly climb and return like angels. Unclosing like a hand you give forever.